Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, who's at 512?
Hi, this is Judy Egner. I mean, Kay George.
Oh, hi, Kay.
I gave you my real name instead of my pen name.
That's okay. So should we call you Kay?
Yes.
Okay. It's good to talk to you.
I'm conscious slip. I'm nervous about all the noise on my line today.
Well, you don't have your speakers on, right?
No, it's just I have a very bad landline. I mean, it's often this way.
Well, I think it'd be okay. I mean, I've heard some other stuff, you know, from the other panel.
If it gets too bad, I'll use my cell phone or Skype or something.
Okay, great. No problem. I think it'd be just fine. There's not too many of us, you know. There's only three other callers on the panel, so it shouldn't be overly crowded. And it'd be fine.
Are you and I the only ones here, I guess, huh?
You and I are the only ones here because this is kind of our practice session. We're actually on the air right now, but because they don't give you. Well, we have somebody, a nice person in the chat room. Manhow is in the chat room right now, but we don't have, we're not addressing the issue. We're just playing around and getting comfortable with each other so that everybody, you know, has a chance to have it go smoothly.
But should I log on online too, you think?
Oh, definitely. If you haven't yet, log on and get on the chat room.
Okay. I'm there.
Okay, good. Because then you can respond to questions in that. And
whoops, I gotta turn my speakers off. Okay.
I know. And my throat's kind of going out on me today. I have a bad cough, so I'm.
You have done a lot on this conference.
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. I have a hard time saying no.
I guess.
it's so, to me, it's such a really great opportunity for learning new technology that can help everyone, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun, and I just have such tremendous respect for Barbara and Rob. That when I found out about it, I thought, oh, I gotta be part of that.
That's what I thought.
Oh, I gotta say hi to Manhow. He just sent us a message. Manhow, if you can hear me, thank you for the comment. And we're waiting for Ken Culkin and Steven to join us. And in the meantime, if you just want to chat and consider this an extension of the coffee bar at the actual conference site, please do. I only wish I had Irish coffee to serve you all.
Oh, I wish you did too.
There's actually a place in San Francisco that says it's the originator of the Irish coffee. It's called the Buena Vista Cafe.
Place.
Have you? Cool.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but it's on a corner. I know what
it
looks
is.
Like, and I could get there again.
It's the Buena Vista Cafe. It's on right above Hyde Street Pier, down by not on Fisherman's Wharf, but
yeah,
on the wharf.
Across from, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Facing it.
Yeah, and their Irish coffee really is the best. I mean, And I've had Irish coffee in various places, although I haven't had it in Ireland, so I probably shouldn't say it's the best.
Well, I actually don't drink Irish coffee.
Uh-huh.
But I have been to the place that invented it.
Oh, good.
I just don't drink coffee. I drink every other form of caffeine.
You like tea?
Yes, I love tea. And Dr. Pepper.
Mmm. Now, I have a family member who grew up in Dallas, so Dr. Pepper is like, you know.
Well, I spent 20 years in Dallas. That's where I
got.
Oh,
wow.
That's where I picked up the addiction.
Yeah, it's easy to get addicted to DP in Dallas, that's for sure. I actually, my first college was the University of Dallas. I attended there on a scholarship.
Oh, you did?
Which, of course, isn't really Dallas. It's Irvine. I mean,
right.
Irving.
It's, yeah, I know the place real well. I played their graduation a couple times. They used to play in a string quartet. And
oh, wow.
They wanted us to play their graduation a couple times.
Yeah, it's a nice. It was a nice campus, but you know, it's a small private Catholic university, and
right.
It became too small and too private for me, so I had to move on.
Yeah.
But it was fun, and it got me a chance to. It gave me a chance to get to Italy, actually, my first trip to Europe when I was 19.
Oh, how fun.
And study there. So I lived there for a semester, thanks to UD, and then I went back and lived in Florence for a whole year later on.
We had an exchange student from Italy a few years ago, and her family lives in a town called Cesena. It's halfway between Florence and Venice.
Mm.
And it's the most wonderful place to visit.
Mm-hmm. I could pretty much say that about any place in Italy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know,
but I mean,
I love the place.
This is a day trip from Florence and a day trip from Venice, and it's about 20 miles from the Adriatic Riviera, and it's about 2 hours from skiing in Switzerland.
So it's ideally located for just about anything you'd want to do.
I can't imagine wanting to live anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And our Italian daughter has, I guess Italians do that. She is a really, really talented graphic designer, but will not leave her small town to find a job using her talents. So she does secretarial work, office work, stuff like that, because there's no market for graphic designers in Cesena. She'd have to go to a bigger town.
Well, good for her. I mean, if her environment is what's making her happy, then...
I mean, that that's...
You know, yeah.
And they live multi-generations in the same house.
Right.
Which
the
is
extended family thing is very good. It's something that we've lost a lot of.
Totally the opposite
America.
Of what my family has done. We are fractured all over the country and have been generation after generation of us just fractures all over the country. And
hold on just for a second. I'm going to see who's also on the air.
Oh, good.
Here. Hi. Who's the 111? Who am we talking to?
111, is that Ken Culkin?
Is that you, Ken? I recognize your voice. Okay,
who's
good. This is Kelly.
Oh, hi, Kelly. Okay, I didn't know if maybe I was interrupting a show already in progress or something.
Well, we actually are on the air, but we're not really doing the show. We're just kicking back and having a pre-show chat, getting used to all the equipment and making sure everybody's signed in at the chat room. And,
Kelly, you know what I've noticed that was a problem for me on some of the radio interviews?
Sure.
Is that I could never tell who was talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, when you ask somebody a question, you know, make sure you're saying their name, or when I talk to somebody, make sure I'm saying their name.
I think that's an excellent observation because, you know, we can't expect everybody to recognize our voices, especially
right.
if they're just joining us in progress. So I think it's a good rule of thumb to identify ourselves, and if we jump in at any moment to make sure we say this is Ken or this is Kay or this is Kelly, so that people know who's
We're
saying
Ken,
what.
We're Ken, Kay, Kelly, and Stephen, aren't we? How funny!
Yeah, got a lot of alliteration going on.
Yeah.
Kay, do you and Ken know each other?
No.
I don't think so, no. I don't know anybody on the panel except you, I believe, Kelly.
Well, let me officially introduce.
Yeah.
Kay George, which is not her real name, Ken, but we're going to call her Kay for now, and Ken Culkin. Ken, I had the pleasure of being on a panel, a live panel, an actual panel, at Left Coast Crime in Denver with Ken, which is where we met last year.
Good. I downloaded your short story from the goodie bag, Ken.
Oh, what was it? I forget.
I forget, too, because I downloaded a whole bunch of them, but they're in a file ready to read at the end of this.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I haven't. You know what? I had a deadline for the, what month is this, November? I had the end of October, I had a deadline for my newest book.
This actually is October.
Yeah, end of September then,
okay.
I guess it was. Okay, whatever. Yeah, what year is it, by the way?
I don't know that.
Anyway, so I just kind of have avoided getting too involved in this stuff because I knew I could get real distracted by it, and I needed all the time I could. I recently became a sort of a single dad, and I've got a 7-year-old, and plus I got other stuff going on, and everything was driving me crazy. So I'm going to probably at certain points sound absolutely stupid about what about this WebCon and everything else.
Now, that would be impossible. You are always a scintillating and fascinating conversationalist.
Well, thanks.
All right?
Okay.
Well, I have a brother who is a single dad to 2 kids, so my hat is off to you. That's a tough job.
Yeah, it's...
I think a single parent anything is a tough job. I mean, parenting's hard enough when there are 2 of you.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. A parent is a tough job.
Yeah, it is.
No matter how you're doing it, so... Anyway, do we need to know anything besides just to talk here? And do we need to know anything technical?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I have a list of questions that I can use to prompt the conversation.
Okay.
But I kind of wanted to have a little bit of time like right now so that we could relax and get comfortable so that it flows as easily and as naturally as possible.
No, that's great. Thank you very much for that. I can use the preparation time.
Well, I just, you know, it's like a panel to me is the best kinds of panels are essentially conversations.
Right.
And they're directed conversations about topics that are interesting to our listeners and readers, hopefully. So, you know, but I want everybody to feel like if they want to bring something up, to bring it up. If you want to talk about anything in particular, do it. You know, I have a list of prompts so that we don't hit any dead airspace.
Okay.
But the idea is just to sort of riff. Think of it as being a jazz symphony on the gumshoe and why, you know, why we're here in all of our various locales teaming up on the internet to talk about PI novels.
Yeah.
So,
are we on for an hour or a half hour?
We're on for an hour.
Okay.
Till 3. In fact, I've got to watch the time very quickly because I'll probably end about right under a minute or just over a minute into the 4 because, like at 59 minutes because I have another, my last and final live event for PP WebCon is a conversation with Rebecca Cantrell, and that's on at 3. So, and I hate being cut off midstream. It's just, it's like a pet peeve. I don't want that to happen to us.
Right. Yeah.
So have you guys been doing other stuff today besides this or so far?
I've done all over the place.
Well, I've done 2 of these so far, but not as a moderator. So, it's been a lot of fun and it's gone well and I've listened to a lot. I heard Lee and Kate Misiak and Lori talk earlier. I listened to Barbara's conversation with Dana Stabenow, and it's been very informative and very entertaining and wonderful. And if you haven't had a chance to go to the coffee shop, I think I saw Kay in there, but I don't think I saw you, Ken. If you have a chance to go in, you should. It's very lively, and there are conversations going on, and you know, it's a chat room, so all you have to do is type.
Right.
So
and you can do that at the same time as the radio panels are on.
Yes, we're doing
that. Yeah. Now, Ken,
I have my computer on my lap, so I could do that, I guess.
That reminds me, are you signed into our chat room for this show?
No,
I'm
not.
About that? Okay,
no.
Well, when you go to the Blog Talk show page that has the episode and a profile of me on it, and it says Why We Love the Gumshoe.
Okay,
and
can
you
show me how
it,
to get there? How do I get there?
Okay,
well,
just
you can
type
do the events
in,
tab.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
What?
You
can
get
do
there
what?
From PP WebCon, too.
Yeah,
you
that's where I'm on the WebCon live page right now. I just signed
okay,
in.
Okay, then find our show and click
okay.
click on it. And then
so
when it says take me to PP WebCon or listen to the show, click on that, and it'll take you to the web page at Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, so I go to – wait.
I could just give you the URL. It probably might be easier. How about that?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay, it's HTTP,
right.
You know, / www.blogtalkradio, all one word, .com, / Kelly, with an I, capital K-E-L-L-I, - Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y, capital S. And that will bring you to the show page.
Oh, capital S?
Mm-hmm.
Capital K and capital S?
Yep.
And then anything after Kelly Stanley?
Nothing else.
Okay. No HTML or...
Nope.
The user page does not exist. I must have typed something wrong. Let me go back and check.
Mine has a lot more stuff on it.
Oh, well, maybe it's because it may be something different than because I signed in. Why don't we take you the long way through the Poison Pen Con?
Okay,
go back to the con web page.
And then click events.
Click events and find where this event is advertised. And then then click on it.
So we're hour 8, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I click what? Click
and
eight.
Then at the bottom of the page that has the more information on it, it'll say something like, listen now at Blog Talk Radio. It's like a little square box.
Oh, I see. It's got all the different stuff, yeah. Why We Love the Gumshoe, and there's your lovely picture and stuff. So I click on that?
Click on that.
Okay. Okay, here I'm there. And then I'm going to the chat room?
No,
well, then
click on live show.
Then you're going to be on the web page that says Kelly Stanley Blog Talk Radio episode on air. And the easiest thing to do would be to look on the profile, on my profile on the right, and there's a green box that says chat now.
I know, I'm not seeing this. The profile on the right? I click your picture?
Wait, what page are you on now, Ken?
It says Live Hour 8, Why We Love the Gumshoe, moderator Kelly Stanley.
Then there's a square down there that says Listen to Kelly Stanley on Air. Blog Talk Radio?
Yeah.
Click on that.
Okay, I get it.
I think you have different screens.
Then profile, and then it says chat now, right?
Right, now click on that.
Okay.
And then you should show
up.
It still says connecting, and it's loading skin, loading language, entering room. Okay, it's
I've got you. You're as guest 2089.
Guest 2089. Okay.
Now you can either stay as a guest, or you can sign in if you have an account, and then you can put in your own name. So if you don't want to hassle with signing in at this point, you know, if you don't have an account, okay.
You mean am I registered, right?
No, I mean for Blog Talk Radio, if you have an account.
Oh, no,
for Blog
I don't. I don't.
Okay. Then don't bother. I'll just tell people that guest 2089. If you decide to chat, just identify yourself, and I'll say guest 2089 is the famous Ken Culkin.
All right. So now are we good? We're going to be doing this while we're also talking?
You don't have to.
You don't have to. It's just an option in case people ask questions or you want to interact with anyone.
In particular.
From the ones I've been on so far today, there's been more activity in terms of questions from the chat room than from people calling in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Okay, so we might get a question on the chat room that we want to talk about, right?
But you can answer them.
Steven, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Great. Thanks for signing in.
Yeah.
We're just making sure we have everything. We're actually on the air right now, but we're just in a holding pattern and getting set up and making sure everybody's in the chat room and smooth before we actually launch. Now, because we started early, we're not going to hear that wonderfully British voice come on and say, "This is Blog Talk Radio." So we'll have to pretend that we hear that voice. I'll try to do it, but, you know.
I heard it already.
My English accent goes in and out, so I can't guarantee that it'll be as effective. Because right now I have us as 9 minutes till the hour in which, and at that point, we'll go live on the Gumshoe. So, Stephen, this is Kay George and
Hi.
Ken Culkin.
Hi.
Hi, Stephen.
And
I'm the one
I don't know.
Whose name doesn't start with a K.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're the only one.
And Kay made a good point earlier, which is that even though there are not a lot of us here, we don't have a five-person panel, it would be a good thing to, before you say anything, to identify yourself for the listeners so that they know who's speaking. And I will do the same, obviously, when I ask questions. And as I was telling Kay and Ken, my philosophy on conference panels is basically to make them as conversational as possible, because that's the fun part, you know, and to make them as easy as possible. So I have a list of questions, but they're mainly prompts in case we hit dead airspace. What I'd like you guys to do is just kind of riff and talk and enjoy, and if there's anything you want to bring up, bring it up, and we'll go from there. And I'm just basically going to try to direct the conversation a little bit if we need to, but other than that, just sort of have a free-flowing talk about the private eye. So that's the aim. And are you signed into the chat room, Stephen?
I'm waiting for the screen to come up.
Okay, good.
I'm signed in Blog Talk, and I clicked on the link from
the
WebCon site.
Okay, good. So you're set up already. Well, that's good. So is everybody having a good time today?
Sure.
It's been fascinating and different.
Yeah, I was. I haven't even already been on. I went to one thing this morning and just briefly, but I've been running around having to take my little girl places all day, so I'm really kind of out of it as far as the WebCon.
Is she in classes, Ken? Is she doing like ballet or soccer or something?
She does softball and ice skating, and today she's got play dates with a friend here and a friend there, which I was trying to set up so I could have some free time, but it doesn't work out that well.
Yeah, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. So.
Well, that's exciting. Softball and ice skating.
Yeah.
That covers during summer and winter.
I was going to say, you got all the seasons going on.
Yeah, I can't imagine anybody getting into ice skating in Southern California, but that's what she's doing, so she loves it.
Well, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, now, Kelly, you're in San Francisco, right?
I am. I'm four blocks from the ocean on the west side of the city, and I'm looking out right now. And normally I can see the ocean from my writing room window, but all I see right now is fog. But it is nice fog. It's fog that's blowing and kind of billowing. It looks like smoke drifting by and obscuring, you know, houses in the back. So
I could use a little bit of fog down here. It's still like 85 degrees.
Woof.
Where are you?
I'm in San Diego. Where are you, Kay?
I'm in Taylor, Texas, outside of Austin.
Oh, okay.
So we're pretty hot, too.
Yeah, I bet.
Not today, though. Pretty nice today.
I'm on the other side in New England, just short of the Cape. So the ocean's maybe 200 yards from me.
Oh,
wow.
Boy.
It's, I don't know, 40s today. Very windy.
Wow.
On and off showers.
Is that usual weather, Stephen, for this time of year?
This time of year, yeah. It's warmer than it usually is this time of year. But we've had a few days that are unseasonably warm, and then it drops 30 degrees, and then today it went up 30 degrees.
So you get your first frost in October usually?
Yeah.
Wow.
Gee. Well, we don't have much to complain about with weather, I'm afraid. I mean, San Francisco has a lot of microclimate, so you can go over to the other side of the city when you're sick of the fog and it'll be sunny.
Yeah.
You know, we just have to worry about earthquakes, which I don't like to even talk about because I think all of us who live here are in a severe state of denial.
Right.
Yeah. I can't even feel them anymore. You know, I've been in California most of my life, and or Southern California and, well, in Northern also, but I can't. I haven't felt an earthquake probably in 20 years. I think I just got numb to them. And people say, oh, did you wake up last night at 3 o'clock? And no. So I just, it's, you know, they're just part of life, I guess.
We got
like
a question.
Breathing. The what?
We got a question in our
chat.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah, excellent. well, take that one.
Start with that one.
Yeah, we can definitely start with that one. That's a terrific question, too.
Yeah.
I did a pre-recorded panel on settings in crime fiction, which was a lot of fun because I moderated it and we did podcasts and I asked everybody to share sound effects of their settings.
Oh.
And then I selected authors from different places, you know, so that we can get a good range, like Hawaii and New England and stuff. So, yeah, it's fun because I think it really does, it has such an impact on us even if we don't think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Environment.
Yeah, I got.
So,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Are we on now? By the way.
We are on the air. I'm just waiting for 3 minutes until we're officially on the air. And
so
then
we should wait to respond to this question until then. Correct.
Yeah, I'll make the official announcement. That, you know, here we are and who we are, and then I will ask you guys to, I will give your names and then ask you to say a few words about yourselves and your books, and then we will go straight to this question and see if we have any others. And as I said, I have a list that we can use as sort of a directional guide and just chat, have fun.
Good.
So let's see, we've got about 2 minutes left by my switchboard before I have to go into my BBC voice.
You know, I've often wondered why it is that even in Southern California, the seems like about half of the people that do radio announcing have British accents.
Americans supposedly have a weak spot for that. You know, you get a lot of receptionists and lawyers' offices
and
doctors' offices who will have a British accent. I often wonder if they send them to some sort of receptionist school just to learn a British accent.
You know, we don't get that in Texas a lot.
Well, Texas is Texas, you know. I mean, come on. When you're in Texas, that's all there is. I was just in the DFW airport on the way back from VoucherCon, and we were lucky enough to find a Dickie's barbecue pit in the American Airlines wing. So I was like, finally, good barbecue. Because, you know, Texas, brisket, the best.
They have too many televisions in that airport. I was trying to get away from the blaring news the last time I was there.
I hate TVs in airports.
Oh, man. I had to go down this little tunnel into some baggage place to get out of the range of all the loud, screaming, commentators.
Yeah.
So we've got about 1 minute, and now we are on the air without even a BBC voice to let us to cue us in. First of all, thank you for tuning in to Why We Love the Gum Show, Gum Shoe, the show about Why We Love the Gum Shoe. The Gum Shoe Show. This is Kelly Stanley, and I am the moderator of three wonderful writers, Kay George, Ken Culkin, and Stephen D. Rogers. And our call-in number, for anyone who is interested in calling in, because we actually have two lines available for guests with questions or observations or comments about our favorite genre, is 347-850-1646. or you can please feel free to text us any questions you may have or comments in the chat room of the Blog Talk Radio. Just sign in and send us a question, and we'll tackle it immediately on the air. So, to start, let's do a round of introductions. Kay, tell us about yourself.
Yeah. Okay, I am a writer who lives in Taylor, outside of Austin, Texas. I'm not native here, as you can probably tell from my accent. I've lived all over the place. I am a short story writer, and I have 3 mystery series that I would love to get published, so if any publishers are out there, take me on. I've really been concentrating on my novels this year, so my most recent short story was at the beginning of the year in Crooked. I have some in Mysterical E. I have some in some defunct magazines. Most of them are defunct. Mouthful of
I think we've all been published in that magazine.
Yeah, those are all gone. In fact, all the other ones are gone. And the only private eye, I have written a private eye short story and a police detective short story.
Terrific.
I guess qualifies me to be on this panel.
Hey, you were interested in it, and that's what qualifies to be on the panel.
Okay.
So, Stephen, how about you?
Yes. I've mostly published short stories, a good number of them in the PI genre. And I have some PI novels that I'm in the process of perfecting and pitching.
Terrific.
And I was also on the table of contents of the defunct magazine.
And where are you writing from? What area of the country?
Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Terrific. Some great PI writers up there.
Yeah.
And Ken, how about you?
I've written a lot of short stories also. I had a couple of them in some recent anthologies. One was in Hollywood and Crime, and one was in History. I don't know. I forget. Crime Through Time recently. And they're both PI novels that are based on the character that I have a series. And it's with Poison Pen Press, and it first came out with another publisher of St. Martin's, and then now all the books are available through Poison Pen Press, and I call it the Tom Hickey California Century novels because my intention is to try to hit as many places and eras in California, 20th century California history as I can, because I think it's been a very fascinating sort of place which people could contend is, you know, is the most important cultural and in a certain sense place in during the 20th century. So I'm trying to kind of catalog that or chronicle that while I tell the mystery stories. The latest one, the one that I just finished, it's called The Biggest Liar in Los Angeles, and it comes out in April from Poison Pen Press, or I guess April or May, I don't know. I think it's May 1st. And,
it's a great title.
Yeah, you know, thank you. I like it. It comes from a sermon of Amy Semple McPherson's, actually.
Ah, not a bad liar in her own right.
She did all right, yeah.
She did okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds terrific. My books are published by, my first book was published by Five Star, but the series has since been, and very recently, picked up by Minotaur, where my second series is housed, and that is the Miranda Corby series. The first one is City of Dragons, which comes out in February, and that is, like you were talking about, Ken, it's set in California, specifically 1940 San Francisco, and Miranda is API. She was also a Spanish Civil War nurse in 1937 and for a brief time an escort. So she is one of the PIs who has a lot of baggage, let's just say. That's a very dark series. There's also a short story attached to it that's going to be out in an ITW anthology in the summer that's mm-hmm. functioning as a prequel to City of Dragons. And this one's set on Treasure Island in 1939 during the World's Fair in San Francisco. And that'll be out in an anthology called First Thrills. That's an ITW anthology in June. So I, you know, the PI has heavily influenced my novel, even though my Roman Britain, my first novel, which was set in Roman Britain, was not officially a PI novel. I tried to make it as much like one in style as I possibly could. So I have an abiding love for the genre, as I think we probably all do. Mm-hmm. So speaking of that, we were very lucky to get a question right off the bat from Manhow, who was here early listening to us natter on about Irish coffee. Wishing that we could have some real Irish coffee rather than virtual Irish coffee. And he asks, how does local weather affect your gumshoes or your writing about them? Which I think is a fascinating question. And really, we can stretch it to include settings. For example, Ken was just discussing, he has a theme that encompasses California history. And Stephen writes from Cape Cod, where he tells us it's already 40 degrees. And Kay is in Texas, which has its own extremely rich culture. So who wants to start? Who wants to tackle that question?
I can.
Okay, great.
The one thing, the most dramatic thing, I think, about the weather, at least in Southern California, is the Santa Ana winds. And they've been used by people a lot more accomplished than I am, but Raymond Chandler has a story called Red Wind that talks about on a night like this, you know, meek little wives, they stare at their husband's throat while they're sharpening their butcher knives or something like that.
It's one of my favorite short stories of all time. I love that story.
Yeah, and, you know, the Santa Anas actually, I think, are exaggerated a little bit in a lot of mysteries, but they do have it. You know, crime goes up during Santa Ana. There's a sort of a tension that plays out in people's. It's almost like a full moon kind of a deal, you know, where people tend to do more radical things during Santa Ana's. And then also, the rain is so rare that sometimes I like to use rain and fog and stuff, even in Southern California, just because people don't think of it. And they can set a very noir mood. I have a novel that I haven't placed at this point that happens almost entirely in the fog, and I just really like that sort of darkness that you can get from using foggy sort of actually almost kind of like unseasonal stuff, like it's something weird, you know, it's not mm-hmm. supposed to happen that way. And in my latest novel, and the biggest liar in Los Angeles, it begins with a lynching in Echo Park in Los Angeles, and it's on the rainiest night of the year, which is almost like a monsoon, and so it's very unclear what happened because there are no witnesses of the events that go on after the lynching. So
that's fascinating. So you really are using the setting to exploit the mood and to exploit the, you know, plot possibilities because of the weather interfering with investigation.
Right.
And to give the writing a sort of cinematic texture. You know, most classic noir that we think of, film noir, you get rainy, dark streets. Weather plays a role. So that's really cool, Ken. Stephen, how about you?
Well, it plays a great deal because writing in New England, the seasons are just so different. I mean, summer on the Cape is incredibly different than winter on the Cape. And so it affects everything. A lot of times when I'm developing a story, one of the first things I have to decide is what part of what month, because that will determine what types of people are around, what the mood is, how tension builds and grows depending on the strains at the time. So the seasons and the weather and the time of year really is a huge impact in the stuff that I write.
And Kay, what about Texas? Do you write about Texas, or do you just write in Texas?
I have a series that I'm trying to place that takes place in West Texas, where I don't live anymore, where I used to live. But being in Austin, I'll tell you what I really like to do is write cold climates, because we had the worst summer anybody's ever had here, you know, this summer. I guess a lot of people did, but it was so hot for so long that I just got great pleasure out of writing people with freezing toes and fingers. kind of cools me off. And I come out of my room just surprised at how hot it is, you know, because I've been cold. My PI story that was in Mysterical E took place during a blizzard because it was on Groundhog Day, and I put it in Pennsylvania, a town with a rival groundhog. And the blizzard snowed everybody into the country club and gave me a nice closed room scenario.
Very cool. So does anyone else other than Ken and I write historical? Because if you're setting your stories in the past, I'm wondering if you also check the weather on that particular date or research it to that degree. I mean, maybe I'm just obsessive compulsive, and yes, I am obsessive compulsive. So if I know that it was raining on a day that I'm setting, I set my novel in, I actually went back and changed weather in the plot in order to reflect historical reality. Do you guys ever do that?
I'm very careful about the weather of what the actual weather was, no matter what I write.
On a particular day, I don't think I've ever done that. No, I mean, if I'm sure, I'm just waiting for somebody to you know, to send me an email and say, you know, it really wasn't raining that day, and then I'll write a.
You know, somebody will.
Witty,
you know,
comment.
That.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I've found sunrise and sunset charts online, so I can get that right.
Oh yeah,
like
good
when
for
the sun
you.
That day.
I think those are really helpful. I mean, yeah. thank goodness we live in this wonderful virtual research world. So just a station break here for a minute. You are listening to Blog Talk Radio and the first ever Poison Pen virtual webcon. Poison Pen is doing a spectacular job of bringing people all over the world today for this historic event. And you are talking with Ken Culkin from San Diego, actually, Stephen D. Rogers from Cape Cod, Kay George from Texas, and Kelly Stanley from San Francisco. And we are discussing why we love the gumshoe. And we are taking questions either through the chat room, and please send them on. We will take them as they come, or you can call in at 347-850-1646. In the meantime, since our topic is why we love the gumshoe, let's just cut right to the chase and answer it. So why do we love the gumshoe? Kay, how about you?
I think I associate noir with gumshoes. I think most people do. It's the quintessential is the 1940s slang and dress and the pulp novels. And it's great escapism. It's a great outlet. The darker, the better for me.
Excellent. We can get in a discussion a little bit later about hard-boiled versus noir, but we'll save that for the end when everybody's tired.
Okay.
So, Ken, how about you? What's your take on what resonates with the private eye genre and writing a private eye character that speaks to you as a writer?
I think it's kind of the lone wolf thing to me. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it seems to me that we are, as human beings, we're in a situation where we often find ourselves feeling friendless and as if we got to take on everything by ourselves. And I think that the PI often finds himself in that situation where it's like, you know, him or her against the whole establishment and the whole, crime cartel or whatever, and without a backup. I mean, police, a lot of times people do, like Mike Conley, for instance. He writes a cop that is just more like a PI than a policeman, in the sense that most policemen work as teams a lot more than, say, Harry Bosch does. And I just was drawn toward the genre, I think, always in reading and in writing, because it feels real to me, in the sense that it feels like something that I, you know, the emotions that are invested in a PI and the sort of the character that's invested in them is something that I can identify with, I think.
Great. Stephen, any comments on that?
Yeah, the thing I love most about the PI is there's like an innate tension between the PI as impartial observer of everything and also PI as catalyst who brings change to everything. I mean, the old cliche that when the PI gets beaten up or threatened, they know they're on the right track.
Right.
Yet they're not really involved with anything.
I think that's an excellent comment, and it kind of strikes strikes a chord with the next question I was going to ask. It segues nicely into it, because I think of the PI as really being a distinctly American invention. You know, if we go back to Hammett and Black Mask and earlier pulps, and yet it's embraced worldwide. And as an American icon, the PI is very reflective of lone gunfighters on par with cowboys, Shane, you know, the man who shot Liberty Valance. I could quote a lot of John Ford movies here at that point. But, you know, and what I want to ask you guys is, looking at it from that point of view, a sort of American cultural icon, what do you think are the necessary characteristics of a compelling PI? You know, take the PIs that you most resonate with. Ken, you're talking about Mike Connolly's, and obviously we're mentioning Chandler and Hammett, who are the progenitors of the genre. So, Kay, why don't you start for us? What are the necessary characteristics of a really good PI, fictional?
Let me think about that. I'm thinking of Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin, who are not they're not like the noir hard-boiled. They're more like cozy PIs.
Mm-hmm.
Across the gamut to, you know, to the most hard-boiled. And what do they all have in common? Except for Archie, who has Nero, they are loners, and they do need to get out there and solve it by themselves. And usually, I think this is an American thing, too. A PI is trying to get as close to the line as he can, or even across it without getting caught. They're not real law-abiding citizens, usually, which also, you know, is something I think readers like to get into vicariously.
I agree with you. I think PIs have to have a capacity for violence that is a violence that exists outside the system, because we often don't feel comfortable with police forces or agents of the government affecting that violence. But we like a heroic outsider who can take care of business, so to speak.
Right.
So, Stephen, what do you think? What are the necessary characteristics for you when you're reading or writing a PI?
Well, what everyone else has said, another thing that the PI does is operate a lot more on all levels of society.
Mm-hmm.
While police officers have the entree to some extent because they can do it, just PI is affected differently. So I like a wide-ranging PI.
Mm-hmm. You mean you like a PI that can fit in many different milieus?
Yeah, it just goes everywhere and does everything.
Okay. And yeah. Ken, how about you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about motive. You know, with a policeman, for instance, he has a job, and it's his job to do whatever he has to do. And if he, you know, he's on a case and he can't say, well, I don't want to do this anymore just because he runs into some trouble. But a PI almost always comes to a point in most good novels that I can think of, where he has to choose to, you know, risk everything more or less. He's getting in deeper than he really ought to, and he doesn't have any backup. And so he has to, you know, plunge into places. And that requires, in my mind, it requires you feeling his motivation, that we can somehow either, you know, be given or sense what it is that makes this person be willing to take these chances. And so you've got that, and then also the fact that you know, that this outside the law business, that seems to me that there's part of us that, you know, most people, that we sort of realize that the law doesn't, you know, it doesn't cut it sometimes, that there's kind of a, you know, there's a need for a moral or heroic force that is even willing to go in places where the law won't, and that's what a PI is willing to do.
Excellent. So this brings up another point, and I'm going to start with Stephen on this one. What Ken's talking about is emotional engagement, that we have to feel the emotional investment that's propelling the PI or the gumshoe into dangerous situations where he or she would be willing to risk everything for the sake of justice, because it's not their job in terms of, you know, it's not like they're a cop and they're being paid to uphold law and order. They work for themselves. So here we go back to the great divide. Hammett's PI, as you all know, Sam Spade, was pretty much of a jerk. He had a code of honor, a very, very strong code of honor, but he was not what you would call a nice guy, or not necessarily, he wasn't a knight-errant. The person who brought us the PI as knight-errant was Chandler. So we've got the two people who arguably invented the genre, sort of who wrote different kinds of PIs. Do you think there's room for both, or do you think that we've gone too far toward Chandler to ever really do a viable Sam Spade type character again?
One of the joys of working in the short form is mm-hmm. that you can deal with any type of character for a short period of time. So, like, I once had a private eye who was hired to see if someone was faking a back injury, and because of the stresses in his life, how he ended up determining whether the person was faking or not was setting the person's home on fire. And then it turned out the person was not faking it. So, you know, this is toward the darker side of the possible PI.
Uh-huh.
But then other times, you know, as soon as I can see different places that a PI can be, I write from that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to explore them all. So I think all of them can work. And you can do shades of them, positive and negative.
Great. How about you, Ken?
Well, what's coming to me is Jake, I can't remember, what was his last name in Chinatown? And, you know, he is not the most scrupulous character on Earth, and basically he's a kind of an ornery guy in the beginning. But as things start going on, then he becomes, you know, the better part of him comes out. And I think that that can be done quite well. As far as making the PI quite as, you know, just as consistently sort of his motives being not so hot as Sam Spade, I can't think of anybody currently that's doing that, but maybe there is. I haven't read everybody, so I would love to see it done and read some and, you know, try to answer that question by some good examples, but I can't think of any offhand.
Well, it's pretty tough because, you know, when you're dealing with a series, you've got to have a character that's going to resonate across books, which usually makes them more emotionally accessible
right.
than Spade was. Although we got a comment from good pal Misty Berry who described Sam Spade as just being less patient rather than being a jerk. And I would counter that by asking Miles's widow whether or not Sam was a jerk.
Right,
He had his code and he had honor, but he wasn't an emotionally accessible man.
Well, you got a guy like I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's okay. I was just gonna come back to Kay to see if she had any comments on the knight errant Chandler's Philip Marlowe versus Sam Spade models for the PI, since they seem to represent sort of the double sided nature of the protagonist in the genre.
Well, what I'm thinking is that there are two different things that the police are involved with and the PIs are involved with. One is the law and one is justice. And the law doesn't always bring about justice, and that's why you have the PI who operates outside the law. That's the way I see it. And whether they're the good PI or the bad PI, I think they're all after some sort of justice. It may be their own sort of justice, and they have their own rules for getting there, but they're all getting to the same place. They're all getting to what they think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, sort of like that great PI Batman. If you really think about it, he is the epitome. I mean, he used to be known as the Dark Knight Detective, and it was for a good reason. I mean, he's like the superhero version of a PI. I grew up reading Batman comics, so I have no problem talking about superheroes. But it's interesting to see him as sort of an extreme fantasy version of a PI. And since we're talking about the shades,
Let me say one more thing.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
There's also you talk about having a really bad person over a series. I don't know how you feel about Dexter, and I don't know how he pulled it off, but that series works for me.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very bad person, and he's not a PI because he works for the cops, but somehow the reader engages with him.
He's definitely emotionally resonant, which I think which I think is a very skillful act to pull off, it is done very well, both in the books and in the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, can I add one thing?
Yeah, please do. Please do.
This is Ken. I think as the genre has sort of progressed in time, that there's almost a requirement that characterization is more important. So if, you know, like Hammett's PI or Sam Spade is, you know, we don't know really as much about him, nor do we know that much about Philip Marlowe. I mean, you could read all of Chandler's books and know less about Philip Marlowe personally and what goes on in his head than you know about many contemporary characters from reading one novel. So the deeper you get into a character, I think the more you have to at least give reasons for his excesses and for his inability to, you know, to be compassionate in some cases or whatever. Like, you know, if you have, for instance, Dave Rovicho, he was a PI sometimes and a cop sometimes, and he's James Lee Burke's character, and he, you know, I would the last thing on earth I'd want to, the last person on earth maybe I'd want to hang out with is Rovicho, because he's very volatile, you know, and he always is going off and he's going to do this and he's not going to hurt anybody, and then as soon as he says that, you know he's going to. But, you know, he just very explosive. But you've got the reasons for it sort of given in the novel, and so that makes that work, and it makes him not a bad guy, even though if we only saw him in one novel or we weren't given those reasons, he might appear to be pretty ragged, you know.
Hold on just for one second. We've actually got a caller.
Okay.
Caller, go ahead. You're on the air at Blog Talk Radio. Sure.
This is Howard Mandel Manhow, and I'd gotten knocked off the email part, so I thought.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. It's interesting. I think that from my reading, the evil PI is a criminal now in a lot of the noirs, and
mm-hmm.
I've just been poking around my bookshelves trying to find Charlie. Guy wrote Six Bad Things, and he's also got a little vampire series going.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's a PI in that he's trying to discover the truth, and he's trying to clear himself, which is, an old trope in detective fiction. So he's doing the investigations, and he's got a code of his own, but he keeps getting more and more and more deeply into criminal life, actually. And I think that that's where the PI has gone, the Spade kind of character, you know.
So you see it as going a little bit more deeper into the dark side, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I think that they have
mm-hmm.
become criminals. I think, like, mm. what I'm reading now, the evil PI, and, I mean, I know that Spade description very well from the very first paragraph. He just is described as Satan. There's a whole
yeah.
series
a blonde
of,
Satan, right.
He has a V in his face. There are Vs all over his face, and it's just very vivid. I think also the Continental Op was kind of a paragon of virtue who precedes Sam Spade. So when you said, well, that's Hammett's PI, I was thinking about the Continental Op, who's actually pretty not a bad guy. I mean, he's got a sense of humor. He's a professional. I mean, that's the thing about it. He's not exactly as tortured as Marlowe is, but he's not evil like
No,
state is,
he's not
state
sentimental,
severe.
But he's an okay guy, and he actually has some emotional reaction to some of the, especially I'm thinking of Red Harvest. He's
right.
Got some emotional reaction going on. That's an excellent observation, Howard, and thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I'm going to get off, otherwise I'll just keep talking, but thank you.
Okay. If you want to say anything else or ask a question, just call back. I'll just go
okay.
ahead and mute you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Stephen here, jump in. Six Bad Things was Charlie Houston.
Oh, right, Charlie Houston. I was trying to remember his last name.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, this kind of brings up the question that I was referring to earlier, which is the eternal hard-boiled versus noir question. I have heard some people claim that you can't have a PI book that is really noir. And these are generally people who prefer the definition of noir as being specifically about somebody who makes a mistake and is screwed on page one. And screwed is a euphemism there. that's a traditional definition given at BoucherCon in noir panels. And that person, you know, from this series of mistakes, it just spirals downhill from that point on. And you think Double Indemnity is a paradigm of noir, particularly the film version of it, that would fit that model, or Out of the Past, which is another great film noir. Because the PI is centered around a protagonist, and usually there is a resolution, a successful resolution of one way or the other for that PI, many people don't feel that it can be termed as noir. Do you guys feel comfortable calling PI novels noir? I mean, I have my own definition. I think noir is more of an umbrella, and PI is a subgenre, hardboiled is a subgenre of it. But what do you guys think? Weigh in on the great hard-boiled noir conversation. So, Kay, you want to start?
Well, I've been in panels, too. There was one at Left Coast Prime about hard-boiled versus noir.
Mm-hmm.
And noir was given as the hopeless situation, that nothing ever is going to be right again. And hard-boiled is... you do right some wrongs, but you get real beat up getting there. So according to that, I suppose you're right that a PI couldn't be noir, but really where the term came from is the French film noir, right? And I think it's an atmosphere, and some PI novels have a lot of noir atmosphere, and maybe technically they should be hard-boiled. I don't, anybody want to... debate me on that?
Ken, Stephen, anybody else want to weigh in on it? I mean, I think as writers, I think we pretty much just write what we want.
Yeah.
And let other people make up their minds. Right. But it's always fun to get into the finer distinctions of hard-boiled versus noir or whatever. Do you guys have any comments on that before we shut it down and move to something else?
Yeah. I just want to say, I think all these labels are kind of, they're kind of marketing tools more than anything
mm-hmm.
else. I mean, you know, you can say noir. People have called my stuff noir ever since before I even knew what it meant, I think, or knew the different definitions, because there are different ones. And some people think of noir as being, you know, essentially 40s and 50s PIs and such as that. And it ranges all the way from that to the more specific, where it has to be a character that has made some big that is spiraling downward. And so, you know, it's people coming up with different definitions. And I think everybody should be able to, you know, write their own dictionary if they want. But I think there's certainly that you can take the feel of, you know, of a noir novel such as a James M. Cain novel, and you can translate that into what's happening in a PI novel, because there are other characters involved too, and there may be a character that's going through a noir-like situation that is the person that the PI is looking for. You know, like for instance, I'll go back to Chinatown, like something that happened to the woman, you know, to the mom whose name I'm forgetting, but you know, she is in this situation that's going down and down and down and down because of things, and then the PI is trying to rescue her. But, you know, it's a PI novel and a sort of a noir novel about the other characters. So they're both working kind of in tandem.
Excellent. I love that. Stephen?
Stephen here. That story that I mentioned, where the PI is trying to prove that the person is either faking the injury or not, but it's a Noah story. He's falling apart at the beginning, and it just he gets progressively in a worse and worse space. And in solving the crime, which you would think would be the good thing that can happen, he does that by killing the person in a horrible way. So it's got the very noir falling apart, starts off bad and gets worse. And at the same time, he actually answers the question he's hired to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just, this is Ken again. I was just thinking, it hadn't even occurred to me, but my novel, the Do-Re-Mi, works that same way. It's the main character, who is the son of Tom Ikey, is he goes from a sort of a... he goes in the course of this investigation, he just keeps sinking down until he ends up someplace at the end that I better not say, but.
Well, that all sounds like a great way of saying that noir and hard-boiled coexist and they're all part of the same package. So it's good to hear that. And I just wanted to add that we are more than halfway through the hour. And if anyone out there wants to call in, we have two lines open. It's 347-850-1646. Or please send us any questions or comments you may have through the chat room, and we will take them on air as they come in. So let's go back to, while we're waiting for questions, let's go back to what Kay mentioned earlier about film. I know I, as a writer, have been extremely influenced by film noir. Often scenes from my books will be directly inspired from a particularly provocative movie or feeling that a film has aroused in me. And some of the best writers in the 20th century worked in Hollywood. You know, we're talking Chandler, of course, and Faulkner and Hammett, Fitzgerald. So tell me about how film noir or film in general has influenced your PI work. And let's start with Stephen.
Well, it's a funny thing, film and PI, because
mm-hmm.
I've been trying to collect PI films, and there aren't that many of them. Gone Baby Gone
mm-hmm.
was, a PI film.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get further back, and it's like, well, then there's Chinatown, and then there's like huge gaps of 10 and 15 years where there's no PI movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the PI is looked at as a genre as moving in cycles, which actually touches on a question I'll ask a little bit later. And it seems to hit particular cultural peaks. For example, in the 80s, PIs were very big, both in books and in other pop culture forms. We had Spencer on TV. Spencer was huge. Robert B. Parker's books were selling like hotcakes everywhere. Sarah Paretsky just published B.I. Warshawski. So PIs were big. And I do think that they are making a resurgence now, but they do tend to seem to work in cycles. I myself look
really
back toward...
Film.
Pardon me?
And not really in film. There's just... It doesn't seem that... We tend to go more for the noir...
Mm-hmm.
Because there aren't
right.
a lot of straight PI movies.
Well, there's Murder, My Sweet, which is a pretty good adaptation. For my money, it's the best adaptation anyone's done of Chandler yet, even though Dick Powell is not my idea of Marlowe. It's still an excellent example of the genre. What about you, Ken? How do you feel about film? Have you been influenced by it? And when we are done with this question, I've got another question in queue waiting. So just to let you guys know.
The only films I think that the only the PI film, as I mentioned, Chinatown, I really love. Now, what was the other one about the Witness, I think, was a wonderful film.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those I think I've taken something from. And I've watched a lot of, the Big Sleep and whatever was Chandler and Hammett and the Maltese Falcon and all those things numerous times. But I don't think I have, I think maybe atmospherically I've taken some stuff from it. But every time that I've watched a film and then gone back and I've usually gone back and tried to read the original novel. So I think the novel, you know, if there is one. I mean, I don't know that Chinatown or Witness even had a novelization, but I find that the novel to be much richer, and I can just, you know, visualize it better. But you know, at the same time, I know I must have picked up some stuff from film, but I can't put my finger on anything in particular.
Kay, how about you?
Well, I'll just broaden it a little. I think that just film in general has influenced novel writing and short story writing, because we all kind of think cinematically. We think in terms of scenes and how a, at least I do, how a camera would pan a scene. And
mm-hmm.
and it's a good way to write a scene, I think, is how a camera would pan it. And it's given novelists a good tool, I think, to write like a movie.
I agree with you. And I think if you have any practice at all in writing screenplays, which I did before I wrote my first book, it's a great tool to help hone dialogue and also mm-hmm. conceptualize the scene so that you can know which details to pick up on. So I think, you know, just being in a visual culture, we can't help but be influenced one way or the other. And we had a good comment.
And I think more people go to see movies, unfortunately, than read mystery novels.
I think you're absolutely right.
Part of the culture.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
If I could add one thing, this is Ken. I think maybe I'm an old fuddy-duddy, I don't know, but I think to some extent the films have been have served novels badly, because they've raised an expectation that something has to be happening almost every minute, and they have made the possibility of digressing or being you know, deeply introspective or whatever very problematic, and I think more to more of a degree than they should. I think they've taken readers' patience away a little bit.
Mm. Well, I'm going to agree with that. That is an influence, and it's the way we have to write now. But I think that's the way of the world. I don't know if it's movies or TV or just general short attention spans. I think it's the way of the world.
Right.
All those years of Mr. Rogers and Captain Kangaroo take their toll. And we have an interesting comment from Misty, who adds that straight mystery films often do weak box office in the initial run. And she gives us an example, an excellent movie, Devil with a Blue Dress, that should have been much bigger in terms of box office than it was. Stephen has agreed with her on, and in the chat room noted that Gone Baby Gone, compared to Mystic River, is another example of the discrepancy. So going away from film for a moment, because we've got two questions in queue, let me get to the first one from BSAC, which is, did any of you pick The Gumshoe as being the easiest way, without learning police procedures, to explain why or how you would have a protagonist solving a crime? In other words, difficult, you know, to make it plausible sometimes if you're a violin teacher and you're stumbling over corpses all the time, whereas a PI would have a plausible reason for engagement. So who wants to take that? Anybody?
I will. I if you want me to. Somebody else wants to lead.
I'd love you to, Ken. Go for it.
Yeah, this is Ken. I chose a PI. Probably there were unconscious reasons, but I wrote a novel. It was called The Loud Adios, and the guy was a military policeman. And some friends of mine, Gail and Dennis Lenz, read the manuscript and suggested that I make him a PI or ex-PI previous to being in the military in World War II and going to sending it off to the St. Martin's PI contest. And so I did that, and I won the contest. So I'm still writing the same character, so I'm kind of got drafted in a sense into the PI genre. But I've never lamented that. I've always felt that was where I should be, and I really feel that for a mystery reader and writer, I have a real lack of interest in police procedure. It just doesn't thrill me at all. It's more the other things that are going on that intrigue me about the novel. So,
okay, Stephen, how about you?
Well, I do write police sometimes and just PI most of the time. One thing about police, the procedure actually most of the time, the police do a certain thing and then the stuff sends out to be tested or someone else has to confirm things. They don't do all the different parts. So that's why police work on many different cases, because they only do certain parts of each case. Whereas with the PI does everything that they can do, which is less than the police can do, but at least they're involved in every aspect of it.
How about you, Kay?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I've written police as well as PIs also, and I, unlike Ken, am very fascinated with police procedures. In fact, I took the Citizens Police Academy course in Austin to learn everything I can about police procedures, and I don't use a lot of police procedures. I just want to make sure I have the background to do them correctly. And the police that I've written, I've dwelt more on, like the one guy, his dilemma was that his wife's brother was breaking into drugstore, and there was a murder that he may have been the murderer, and his dilemma was that it was his wife's brother. But so it's more of a, there was more personal involvement than police procedure in that, because he wasn't the homicide detective or anything. So the question was, is the PI easier to write than the policeman?
Well, as an easier way of getting the protagonist involved,
I think you can get anybody involved. Like you say, you can get a violin teacher involved if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Take a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a violin teacher. I bet I could
do it. Oh, wow. How cool. Oh, that's neat. Okay, great. Well, let's go to another question here before we start running out of time, and it's from A.M. Katwar, if I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the question is, can any of you speak to how well The Gumshoe works cross-genre? So do I. We have any volunteers?
Would this be talking about, let's say, mystery to literary or mystery to suspense or what?
No,
I'm not sure exactly what genre.
It's not specified, so why don't you interpret it as you like.
Gosh.
Let's tackle the literary aspect of it for want of any other genre, because I do think that the PI and noir tend to get more of a literary reputation, maybe because of its founders. And what do you guys think about that? How do you think it works as a literary novel? I mean, Chandler compared it to Tilting at Windmills, and was very specific in the essays that he wrote that he was trying to write something that would last, stand the testament of time, and he had literary ambitions. In fact, he wanted to be a poet when he was younger and wrote some poetry in England. So what do you guys think about the literary PI or cross-genre in general? How about you, anybody?
Stephen.
Yeah, please.
Well, I've written romance stories that involve the PI. I've had science fiction stories that involved PIs, horror stories. It's very easy to take a PI horror mix because they're going into a thing that they don't know what's going on, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the evil corporation that's responsible for something. It could be, you know, whatever aspect of weirdness you want to throw. So I think it works very well cross-genre.
Great. And we've heard back from our questioner who adds that he or she is talking about literary sci-fi and even some newer romances. So sci-fi PI reminds me of Harrison Ford movie directed by Ridley Scott, very famous. I'm having a brain lapse here.
Blade Runner.
Thank
oh,
you.
Yeah.
I think that's like the sort of iconic example of how you can combine sci-fi with a basic PI story. What do you guys think?
Anybody have it?
This is Kay. The two things that left in my mind when you read cross genre were paranormal and humorous. I think you can do PIs real easily with werewolves and vampires and a lot of humor, because there's so much that's so cliche in the genre that I think you can use that for humor real easily.
Cool. And hang on one moment, because we've got another caller online, and we can get back to that. Okay, we've got area code 212 online. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, is that me again? This is Manhow calling back.
Oh, hi.
You know, you're talking about literary. I mean, the PI, if it's just a private investigator, somebody's, I mean, doesn't it go back to Oedipus, sort of? Or I've also read, I think, in Dorothy Sayers' collection, she talks about Daniel in the Bible.
Oh, sure.
You know, being an investigator who's trying to figure out who's feeding, why the gods are eating, why the statues are eating.
Yeah, I always use Oedipus as an example of noir. Because I think it's you can't get more noir than somebody who, you know, accidentally kills his father and marries his mother and gets blinded and ostracized and thrown out of his city.
Right.
I'd say that's pretty noir.
What about the Robespierre version, you know, which the detective goes out and ends up tracing himself as being the killer?
Mm-hmm. I think that's excellent. So that would be a nice version of literary noir for sure.
You got you wouldn't call him exactly a private investigator, but an amateur sleuth. You got Hamlet, right?
That's what I was thinking, Hamlet.
Oh, yeah, you're right, absolutely.
So much literature is about, like, finding this truth, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and upholding some sort of code and figuring out how it's bent, you know, to get to it. Even Lord of the Rings or almost any, I mean, it's a huge branch of quest fiction, it seems like.
Yeah, they're all
on
a journey.
I'm sorry, this is Ken. The only thing that I think would hold PI back from being more literary would be the readership, and that a lot of people, if they buy it, they expect it to move at a certain pace and so on, and maybe to do justice to any sort of literary ambitions, it would have to slow down or do something real original that wouldn't meet the expectations of some of the readers, so that people may shy away from it.
Do you think
but
it's
certainly a possibility. I'm sorry, what?
Do you think Sherlock Holmes is still read popularly? Because he doesn't move very fast, but...
No.
Again, for a PI, he's sort of a model for a lot of what you folks have been talking about.
That's a good question. If Sherlock Holmes would actually be popular if at that slow pace if he were published today, and if he still read a lot or just talked about a lot, I don't know.
Or what about G.K. Chesterton or Philo Vance or, you know, Father Brown? I mean, I think you'd have a hard time getting some of these guys published, because I think also what we're verging on here is talking about the differences between PIs and mysteries and thrillers. And I think we have seen recently in publishing, as well as in film, a huge appetite for a very fast-paced thriller as being a big blockbuster. Right. And thrillers definitely have a different kind of pace, and they have a different kind of center. It's not really about the quest. It's about the race against time most often. We also have a nice comment here before we get back to the conversation that Misty wanted to add, that she thinks there's a mystery at the core of every good novel. And I think that touches on what Howard was commenting on earlier about quests. And Kay touched on also the hero's journey. You know, these are giant emblematic themes, not just used by George Lucas, but as the conversation is demonstrating, it goes pretty far back in time. So
the interesting thing to me is, excuse me for a minute,
sure,
how the PI is working now, because it's one thing about Holmes is, like, he just deduced things. He had a lot of information. And today, the PI has to have an incredible amount of ability to get information that other people don't have. I mean, since we've got Google and the Internet and you can really do any kind of research you want, it seems like the PI almost has to be a wizard if they're really going to put together clues and look at the forensics and that kind of stuff, or instead of just throwing themselves into the neighborhood and kind of roughing up some people and asking some questions and figuring
mm-hmm.
things that way. But right. the amount of information that they would really have to be, it's daunting to me to think about how much My PI would have to know, you know, if he was really going into business today. You know, if he was going to even hang out a shingle, he'd have to have a lot of computer skills and research abilities to call himself a private investigator and get hired by anybody.
That's true. So we also have another comment question here. Oh, thank you, Howard. Thank you for calling. We also have another comment here in the chat room, and we've got approximately 5 minutes remaining. So this may be one of the last questions we take, which is from Lillian. And she asks us about, she's curious about the marketing aspect of this genre in particular, and whether or not there are techniques used by mystery genre authors that work well for our targeted audience. Kay, do you want to take that one?
Techniques that work well for our targeted audience. Well,
yeah.
We hope that our techniques work well for our targeted audiences. a genre writer has a lot of techniques at their disposal, and the story arc, if you're writing a novel, the parallel storylines or the cliffhangers or the parallel plots, the new thing you have to do is draw your reader at the beginning. I'm more of a short story writer, so I don't have to worry about cliffhangers so much. Just whipping through the story real fast.
And I got to say, you know, short stories are, I have such awe over short stories because they are really, really difficult to write.
I think a person is either a natural short story writer or a natural novelist, and short stories are much easier for me to write. I think in short stories.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think you're probably right because it's always I've written have taken me far longer to write than their length would imply. Because usually I wind up frustrated because my plot wants to explode, you know. But I think, you know, we had in the 30s and 40s, we had so many great writers who were trained in short stories and then wound up, well, both Hammett and Chandler both wound up using short stories and combining them and recombining them and editing them and making them novels. And I really wish we had more venues for that sort of training. But I think that's another gift that the Internet has given us because even though, you know, we've all been part of a defunct magazine, there are plenty of other venues out there online that are publishing new writers and emerging writers and short story writers. So I think we're lucky in that we're seeing a kind of a renaissance for short stories. What do you guys say?
Are we talking about short stories or marketing?
Oh, both.
Okay.
We've got 4 minutes. We have to talk about everything and anything. So, actually, only 2 minutes.
I was just thinking about this marketing question. This is Ken, and it seems to me that what a person needs to do, and I'm not very good at marketing, I don't think, but a few things that I've gleaned is that what a mystery novelist or anybody in the crime genre, perhaps any genre, needs to do is sort of find a niche with a sort of a brand that takes them someplace. I remember when I first started writing mysteries and I did my first book signing and I was in a store and I mentioned to the bookstore owner that I thought that the A is for alibi and the B is for, you know, whatever it is and so on, the Sue Grafton's things, that was really kind of lame. I mean, I like her novels fine, but I didn't like that title thing. And this bookstore owner was appalled because, oh, no, she says people come in and they just ask for the alibi lady.
Guys, I'm going to just cut you off because we've got about a few seconds left, and I want to thank you. Thank you, Ken, for that discussion. Thank you all for joining us. And if anyone has any more questions, please join us later in the coffee bar at Virtual Con, or you can hang around at the chat room. Some of us may be there. I won't be because I have another talk show immediately after this. But thank you all for joining us. I hope you had a good time. And
thank you,
panel.
Kelly.
It was
thank
wonderful.
You.
It was great to hear from you. And you guys are all terrific. So thanks again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.